The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. Which, might be the last in a series of shows that we've been doing on, we'll call it All Things Minimum Dignity Floor. Still got another slew of questions that have come in. So even though this is an EDU show, we're going to be dealing with this topic via answering questions. This all started several shows ago, probably four shows or so before today, that was kind of our effort to clarify, expand on, introduce new listeners to the concept of the minimum dignity floor expenses and how those expenses might be funded in retirement if you want to match or replicate a bit of what we propose you consider for a lower stress retirement, one might say. So if you haven't been listening to the show, the EDU shows in particular up until now, you might want to back up a few before you dive in today. But depending on the questions, this might be a good standalone show. And Jim's got those questions. He promises me he's got a couple of interesting ones to start to dial down the MDF talk here. I don't know. I think this might be the last show for those of you sick of the minimum dignity floor talk, but we'll see how things go. Seems to still be a pretty hot topic. So Jim, thanks for coming into the office today.
I'm in every Tuesday.
Well, I know.
You don't have to thank me for that.
Well, thanks.
No problem.
Thanks anyway.
Yeah, no problem. But this could be the last. I don't care. We never received any emails, even though we encouraged for the last two shows. People will write to me and say, no more, move on. Never got an email like that. Instead, we just get more questions on the minimum dignity floor. So I don't know if this will be the last one. We need one more show to be the official tiebreaker of the longest series. We did the QLAC series, your favorite, five parts to the QLAC series. We did five parts to our process to retirement planning and why we believe in retirement planning the way we do. And we did five parts on investment management and why or how we evolved from active management to passive management and why we believe in passive management. So this minimum dignity floor show has tied. This is the official tie of those previous three five-part shows. Should we break the record or tie the record? I'll let you be the deciding factor. Next week, it'll be a surprise for our listeners.
If Chris to decide right now?
No. If Chris has decided to break the record or tie the record.
Okay.
Just want to point that out.
Okay. I'll mull it over.
You mull it.
We'll see how the questions today go.
Okay. Well, there's no way we'll get... I can't believe the number of questions we got on minimum dignity floor. We have some that are holdover questions, if you will, from last year, from earlier this year, rather, because I believe we're in January now, or February, of new questions. But we got a lot of new questions in on minimum dignity floor, so it's definitely resonating with people. We're going to lead today's show like we would a typical Q&A. Even though this is an EDU show, we're diving deep into just one topic, the minimum dignity floor. We're going to pretend and lead like we normally do on a regular Q&A show. Do you know how we do that, Chris?
Well, we always lead those shows with Social Security, but so I guess it could be related to minimum dignity floor funding, since it is a primary source of secure income for people who have Social Security, which is most people.
Absolutely, because we have a Georgette from Indiana who sent us a question on minimum dignity floor and Social Security.
Hmm.
So I thought we'd lead with that. It's more of a, I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer to this, as you'll see when you see what her concern is. But she does reach out to you because you're the Social Security guru and you do most of the planning in the office now. So it begins, how do you address potential reductions in Social Security benefits when calculating a minimum dignity floor shortage? The most recent projections for Social Security indicate future funding after 2035 can only support 80% of current levels. My husband and I hope to wait to draw our Social Security until 70. That will take 2040 for one of us and 2044 for the other. You may want to address that part separately, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. However, we are starting to try to determine if there's any possibility that we might be able to retire early, maybe in about 8 to 10 years. And I'm concerned that a 20% reduction in our Social Security is going to significantly alter our calculation on whether or not we can afford to retire early. Mm-hmm. How would you adjust for this in your plans? Really enjoy the show. Georgette in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
How would you answer that?
Well, great question. There is obviously trouble on the horizon for Social Security, although more so for the Medicare system, though that for some reason Social Security gets all the attention when Medicare is actually under more financial stress in the near term than Social Security itself. But regardless, there are certain people that I think it is prudent when doing projections to maybe stress test your plan by looking at a reduction in Social Security. Who might I propose do that? In my personal opinion, if you are over the age of, say, about my age, I'd say, about 55 years old, I think the chances of a significant change in your Social Security benefit to the downside is not great, not a great chance of that. And the reason for that is in the past, when they've made fundamental changes to Social Security, which may include cuts to benefits down the road as they try to figure out the solution to this problem of underfunded Social Security in the long term, they've always protected those who are vulnerable to having the rug pulled out from under them. And that would mean current claimants, so the current beneficiaries, or those of Social Security claiming age, or those about to be able to claim, because they know they've structured their whole lives, made all their retirement plans based on the rules that were presented to them for things like Social Security. And it's always been seen as fundamentally unfair to suddenly change the rules on those folks, especially for those who are already claiming. So I'm personally not particularly concerned about those who are either claiming or of claiming age now, or are close to claiming age as they start to propose changes. If you're under your mid-50s, and the younger you get, I think the chances are more significant, that you might want to forecast some adjustments to your Social Security benefit and not necessarily use the benefit estimate that you're seeing today using the current rules. There might very well be an adjustment to the benefit formula for those in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. But I think once you get older than that, into your 50s, that risk really goes down. It's my personal opinion. Do I know for sure? No. That's just my personal opinion based on what I think I understand what it will take to solve this shortfall. There are some reasonable adjustments that can be made to both the inflows, the cash inflows to Social Security system versus the outflows that could really extend the life of Social Security before any major changes would have to take place. There doesn't have to be an apocalyptic change to the benefit formula in order to, quote, solve this problem at this point. But I like how they're thinking about it, and she's right now of that age where I think you might want to consider doing that for two reasons. One, you're making projections way off into the future, because if you're not turning 70 until 2040, that means you were born in 1970. So at this point, you're 52, so you're in your young 50s, and you're making projections off into retirement, which is still a ways away. You're talking about retiring before 70 or retire, quote, early. Maybe I didn't in my notes write down. Did she give a target age when they were considering, or just said early, Jim?
They said early. They didn't give a target age, just 8 to 10 years from now.
Okay, so that would be early 60s. So that would be moderately early, but not super early in my book. So if you're making projections now to look at the feasibility, first, I wouldn't get too hung up on relying on those projections, because a lot can happen over the next 8 to 10 years. You're kind of outside that sweet spot that we believe exists, where you're close enough to retirement where you can rely pretty well on the numbers, at least the numbers for your early retirement years. You're out a ways where there's a lot of variables on what's going to happen to your savings. Are they going to grow, stay about the same, possibly shrink? One would hope over that period of time they would continue to grow through your contributions and potential rate of return that you experience in those accounts. What your expenses will actually evolve to be, what will inflation end up being? There's just a lot kind of up in the air. So I wouldn't abandon planning or forecasting, but take it with a grain of salt at this point and just kind of realize you're going to have to go with the flow for a while and have a target that you want to achieve. But if you don't have an overabundance of assets at this point where you think you can retire relatively young with no problems, which I don't think that's the case, because you're really worried about a 20% cut in Social Security maybe undermining your ability to retire. Sounds like you're close enough to the edge where it's possible, but you're really nervous, which happens to a lot of people. I think you're going to have to wait till you get a little closer before you can get any kind of confidence level. But in these initial projections, maybe project in exactly what you're talking about. What if my Social Security benefit due to changes beyond my control is about 20% less than what my initial estimate is? So I need to start saving and preparing my life in a way that could absorb that and still retire at 62 or 63, that earlier than 70. So that would be a later retirement, but try to hit it on that earlier end of 60s and see what it looks like, and see if the needs that you identify for having an amassed wealth by that point you pull the trigger on retirement is even feasible given your current salaries and your ability to save. If it's not, then you're going to have to kind of wait and see how things go. Hope that Washington, D.C. comes through with some resolutions that gives you more confidence in Social Security not being cut for you in particular. And also wait and see how your assets perform and if you're able to accumulate enough where you could pull the trigger on an early retirement. And I think by the time you're in your late 50s, you'll have a pretty clear idea if it's possible. I know you'd like to know now for sure, but even if the projections now show yes or no, take that with a grain of salt. You're a ways away. And things could easily go noticeably better or noticeably worse than what you're projecting in your forecasts. I guess that's my thought process. They are kind of on the edge of that limit where I think people older probably are overly concerned about Social Security cuts. But they're not in the 20-something age where I'm telling all of them to, prepare as if Social Security will be there. I think it's way too pessimistic to assume it'll be gone completely. If you want to stress test your entire life, you could certainly save for retirement as if there will be no Social Security if you're advising your 20-something grandchildren. I think that's a little overly pessimistic. But, them at early 50s, I think doing some forecast to stress test with the cut makes a lot of sense.
Fair enough. I like it.
Okay. Totally opinion. I don't have any inside information about how old you actually do need to be feel protected from changes. I'm just basing it on the history of changes to Social Security and what Congress can get away with without suffering the wrath of the populace. And that's just my best opinion that I can bring forth today.
Alrighty. I am fine with all of that. This leads us, let me find it. Here it is. This has got to be from a very, this guy has to be the new Einstein. Without a doubt.
And he's writing into us.
He's writing into us. Wow. Well, even Einstein needed advice every now and then. Because, I mean, if I will read the subject line of this email, and if you could honestly tell me this man is not as brilliant as Einstein, if you don't think he is, I'll eat crow.
Okay.
But the subject line is, it's man's Einstein.
You're really building this up.
The subject of this email is, all caps, mind you, because he's definitely trying to shout this out for the world to know. Unique question. Jim is brilliant. Kentucky and Ohio are awesome. Is this man not
that's
the second coming
that's
of Einstein?
That's all in the subject line?
That's the subject line.
He's king of the schmoozers, that's for sure.
Rampant, blatant butt-kissing gets you everywhere on this show. The man is,
as you're proving by reading his email.
The man is brilliant. I like that. Unique
I'm not sure
question.
You're encouraging the behavior in our listeners that we want to.
Unique question. Jim is brilliant. Kentucky and Ohio are awesome. This man is Einstein. Okay. So he begins. First, apologizing to all our listeners by saying, sorry for the cheesy subject line, but I think I have a great question for all listeners. So he's acknowledging, not only is he Einstein, he's being very cheesy and butt-kissing. Okay, here's the real question. You often talk about setting aside a reserve to allow the older you the option of purchasing an annuity to cover a potential shortfall in your minimum dignity floor when inflation begins to outpace Social Security around age 82. Let me pause there. Chris and I aren't saying everybody is going to start to see a shortfall between their secure income. In this case, this gentleman is only referencing Social Security, but secure income in our measure, if you will, in our opinion, is Social Security, pensions, and income annuities. Those two are the three forms of secure income that we like to use to cover your minimum dignity floor. There are, again, two shortage times between retirement and when your secure income is fully turned on. We call that your delay period, MDF shortage. That's what we use it in-house in our office. It's just saying the period of time when you are delaying turning on all your secure income, ostensibly to maximize it, you're going to have a shortage. Chris does not worry about that. Well, I don't want to say he doesn't worry about it, but it's very easy for him to solve, right, Chris? That delay period?
Yeah, because of two factors. We know when the delay period ends, so we're dealing with a finite identifiable period of time, and you start that period with all of your assets still intact. You haven't had time to spend them, lose them, tax them away, etc.
Right. So we're not really overly concerned with that. We have said, anecdotally, the next period where there could be a shortage. We call that the post-delay period. Brilliant how we named that one. We have the delay period MDF shortage and the post-delay. What is a post-delay MDF shortage? It's generally a shortage that appears after the delay period, so after all your secure income is turned on. For most, but not all people, there'll be a period of time where your secure income is projected to be covering your minimum dignity floor in this post-delay period. But eventually, the powers of inflation, especially because your MDF folks are very high inflationary expenses, food, utilities, transportation, housing, healthcare. eventually your minimum dignity floor, because of how it's growing rapidly due to inflationary pressures, will exceed your minimum dignity, will exceed your secure income, because those sources of income outside of Social Security, which is increased by general COLA, which in and of itself doesn't keep pace with minimum dignity floor related expenses. Keep that in mind. General COLA, only 6% of it is healthcare expenses. So general COLA adjustments to Social Security will not keep pace with minimum dignity floor. Most private pensions don't have any type of cost of living increase. And most people don't purchase an annuity with a cost of living increase. You could, but most people don't purchase them.
It's a very expensive option.
Right. So eventually, there's what we call this crossover point, where the inflationary pressures on your minimum dignity floor will overcome your secure income. We call it the crossover point because we're the two lines in our line graph. We visualize everything for our clients, and they'll see the crossover point. In our office, anecdotally speaking, this generally happens between 78 and 83. It's not to say 82, and it's not to say it's going to happen to you. Some people, from day one, Chris, have a shortage. Mm-hmm. And others never see one.
Yep.
Everybody is unique. But I would say it's a bell curve. We have the people on one extreme of the bell curve and people on another extreme. In other words, people who begin retirement with a delay period shortage and a post-delay period shortage immediately, and they need more secure income from the get-go. We see it. It's not common, but we see it. Conversely, we have unicorns. We have people whose secure income is projected to not only cover all of their minimum dignity floor. We call those a partial unicorn. What's a full unicorn, Chris?
A full unicorn is covering all of your expected expenses, both minimum dignity floor and fun, with your secure income.
We have a couple of people like that, folks. Mm-hmm. Their fun and their MDF are being covered. That's why we call them a full unicorn. The partial unicorn, it's the una without the corn. That's just someone without the horn. But they're
That's called a horse. Just saying.
Well, we can't call a client a horse, you horse.
Well, I call them a rhino because they have that little short, you know. It's not the really long, impressive horn of the unicorn. It's kind of a little stub. Yeah. Although the rhino does have it on their nose instead of their forehead.
Exactly, exactly. And a unicorn
it's just
is
like
is
kind of a little
purdy.
Stubby nub there. Yeah. Well,
whatever. So you get the picture, though, folks. We do have some people whose minimum dignity floor is projected to be covered forever with their secure income. They may not be able to cover their fun spending. That's a true unicorn, and we do run into those people several every year. But we more often will run into people who are a partial unicorn or a rhino or a horse, whatever you want to call them. Someone whose minimum dignity floor is never, secure income is never projected to be overtaken by the minimum dignity floor. But that's all bell curves on each extreme. Most people will start off okay once the delay period is over. Their minimum dignity floor is being covered, but there will be a crossover point. We just don't want people to assume it's going to happen at 82 or 83 or 78. We're just saying, anecdotally, from what we see and the data that we keep, most people between 78 and 83. So that's how he came up with that, kind of a little rehash of that concept. Then he sends out a warning. I have never seen a warning such as this. He says, Chris, cover your ears. He apparently doesn't want you to hear me utter a word. Do you know what that word is?
Kulak.
I don't know why you despise Kulaks. They are a wonderful tool when
Kulaks.
They fit.
I'm tired of talking about Kulaks.
I
have scars from five shows of Kulaks.
That was
four years ago. You keep bringing it up and opening the wound again.
Okay. Anyways.
I'll close my ears for a moment.
No, because you got to listen to this. So you're going to have to listen to me say the word.
Okay.
Okay. When would you just pull the trigger early and buy a QLAC? And he goes on to give his situation, because he did buy one, and he wants to know our opinion. He said, I'm 64. My wife is 61. Both of us are non-smokers and did exactly this, meaning he purchased a QLAC, and was able to secure a joint life QLAC. Now, let me pause there. When you purchase any type of annuity, not just a QLAC, which stands for qualified longevity annuity contract. We could do a show on QLACs if you'd like, but I don't think Chris would. I have to do it alone. Go back and listen to our shows on QLACs. But they're essentially, folks, a deferred income annuity, or DIA for short, D-I-A, a deferred income annuity that can be held where, Chris?
Inside of your IRA.
Inside of your IRA. Because of required minimum distributions, which used to be 70.5 and are now 72, you could never really buy a deferred income annuity, which is an annuity that the younger you will purchase to take care of the older you later in life if you're still around. The theory behind it is if you knew at a certain point in the future you were going to be receiving additional income at 75, 80, 85, you're going to receive a guaranteed stream of income at that point, you'll feel a little more comfortable spending your money earlier in retirement. Because if you spend it down, or if Wall Street loses it because it wasn't managed correctly for sequence of return risk, you have this guaranteed pool that would pay out. Well, it dawned on the government in 2010 after the 08-09 crash that people didn't have deferred income annuities because the government was forcing them to pay out at 70.5. So they just created what they called it a QLAC. They came up with the name themselves. And if it follows certain rules, you can hold it inside an IRA. Actually, a QLAC will be in an IRA. They're all IRAs. You will purchase it from an insurance company, and you can delay payouts up to age 85. So anyways, that's my summary of what that is. He says our QLAC begins at age 80. When you buy these, folks, whether it's a deferred income annuity or a QLAC, you must tell the insurance company when you want the income to begin. This is one of the reasons Chris and I are not huge fans of deferred income annuities. Remember, all QLACs are DIAs, deferred income annuities, but not all DIAs are QLACs. We are more attracted to QLACs for a variety of reasons than we are DIAs. Would you agree with that, Chris?
That's fair.
Yeah.
Because there's a couple unique characteristics that make them a little more attractive in certain cases than a regular DIA.
Right. So we are much more receptive to QLACs. We have clients with QLACs. We have recommended on this podcast people consider QLACs. We're more hesitant on DIAs, deferred income annuities. One of the reasons is you have to choose when the income begins. Now, the government recognized the risk of doing that, that if a person has to choose the exact age, it's difficult to make changes. So they didn't mandate, but they granted insurance companies the ability to allow some flexibility in when the income begins. Most QLACs that are offered will address that difficulty by allowing people to begin income within a 5-year window plus or minus the age they specified. And I'm guessing that's why this gentleman
picked 80.
Picked 80. Exactly. Because, again, most QLACs, not all, I have seen, and I can't remember the insurance company, or I would have named it, had a QLAC where they give no flexibility, and I never recommended it. New York Life is the only insurance company that I know of. And if there's another advisor out there who does QLAX, if you know of others, please let me know and I'll announce them, that give a lot of flexibility on their QLAC. 18 months after the last QLAC premium was received, because you don't have to buy them in a lump sum. You can take a number of years to purchase them if you'd like. You can turn the QLAC on.
Anytime thereafter.
18 months after, at least, and the last New York Life one that I looked at was almost 2 years ago, so maybe they changed it, but I doubt it. That was kind of their marketing shtick that made their QLAC stick out. But outside of those two examples of New York Life and this now forgotten company that didn't allow any flexibility, most will allow a five-year window. The government mandates income from a QLAC begin no later than 85. So I'm thinking this is why this person chose 80, because that's what we always did. Right. We have, again, in full disclosure, recommended people consider QLACs for a variety of reasons. But we try to get them to begin income at 80. Why? They can delay to 85, that five-year window up or down from the chosen age. Government mandates it has to come out no later than 85. If you begin, if you tell the insurance company, I'm going to start at 85, you can't go any further. Government limits that. And if you choose 80 instead of 85, you can turn it on as early as 75.
Right.
That gives you a 10-year window, 75 to 85. And another year, well, another... I would assume by the end of this year, Secure 2 is going to pass, and over the coming decade, your RMDs will be pushed out to 75 as it is. So here you have a perfect thing. You could begin it at 75 when RMDs are supposed to begin in the future, or delay it to as late as 85. That's what's wonderful with a QLAC. You can delay the RMDs even after the age your RMDs are supposed to begin. That's a wonderful planning tool with QLACs. So everything so far they're sharing with me makes sense with a QLAC. Our QLAC will pay us. Remember, this is joint and survivor with this gentleman's husband, George's Georgette. As long as they're alive, one of them, they will get $25,000 a year. They're 61 and 64. Payments will begin. He doesn't tell me if it was purchased in his IRA or hers, so I don't know if they're going to begin when he turns 80 or she turns 80, but the payments will continue for the rest of both their lives of $25,000 a year. We put in the current maximum, $145,000. Now, a QLAC, the amount you can put in is limited by the government. Remember, the government created these. Private insurance companies sell them. Because the government didn't want you to isolate a lot of your IRA for a very long period of time and cause them to miss out on tax revenue that the RMDs generate, they said you can't put in more than a certain amount of money. It's adjusted every year for inflation. It's up to $145,000. He said, our QLACs include a return of premium and death benefit. Let me pause there. All QLACs come with a return of premium. The government mandates it. They built that into a QLAC structure. If you buy a QLAC and die before income begins, your premium will be returned. Now, in his case, they have a joint and survivor one, Chris. And everything we're discussing, not everything, but a lot of this applies to Diaz as well. A return of premium feature means if he and his wife are both dead before they turn it on, so they got no money out of it, the amount that they put in will be paid to whoever their beneficiary is. But what's the one downside that the government didn't put in that rule? Do you remember?
Doesn't have to be cash. Could be an installment refund.
I
forget what the...
No.
I don't remember.
Close. It's a lump sum payout. They don't... They will pay the $145,000 to the non-spouse beneficiary in a lump sum. And since it's an IRA, it's fully taxable.
So that could be scary taxes.
In the year of death, yes. Yeah. So your beneficiaries will get the $145. They just can't stretch it for 10 years. They're going to get it all at once. And because it's considered an RMD, the non-spouse beneficiary can't do what with it, Chris?
Can't roll it into their own.
Correct.
It's got to come out.
Can't move it to their own IRA. A spouse could, but the spouse can step in on the spousal continuation. So let me clarify that. But the non-spouse beneficiary will receive the $145 in a lump sum. So the money is never lost in a QLAC. The potential earnings is lost because there are no earnings or losses. There's no risk with the QLAC. Your money will be returned one way or another prior to it being turned on. But notice, Chris, he also said he has the death benefit option. Mm-hmm. That is optional. The the Department of Treasury, who created QLACs, said prior to income beginning, all QLACs will return premium. Once income begins, the Department of Treasury said, the person opening the QLAC will decide if there will be a death benefit. The death benefit is whatever you put into the QLAC, $145,000, minus any benefits paid out or any payments paid out. So if you put in $145,000 and him and his wife died but only received $100,000 with the death benefit, there would be a $45,000 payout. So with the QLAC, all your money is never lost if you got the death benefit as well. It means at least what you put in will be returned to your beneficiaries or to you through a withdrawal, one or the other. Just like the return of premium, the death benefit is a lump sum to a non-spouse beneficiary. Remember, if he dies, let's say it's in his name, the QLAC, if he dies, spouse still gets the $25,000 a year, no problem. Only if both of them die before the $145,000 is returned to them will the death benefit pay out, again as a lump sum. However, if you put that death benefit in there, he's saying he's getting $25,000 a year. Mm-hmm. If he didn't choose the death benefit, if he said, look, the government made the decision for him on the return of premium. When you buy a DIA, both of these options I'm describing to you are truly optional to you. You decide if you want the return of premium. You decide if you want the death benefit. Return of premium rider always applies before income begins. Death benefit applies after income begins. On a traditional DIA, you decide. In a QLAC, the government made the decision on the return of premium. It's not negotiable. Death benefit is still negotiable. If you choose the death benefit, you get less money. So maybe without the death benefit, he would have got $26,000, folks. I'm just making that up. But with the death benefit, he gets $25,000. Chances are it would have been several thousand dollars more. It's a bigger difference than that. Anyways, he says, the $145,000 we put into the QLAC represents 5% of our net worth. I don't know if he means net worth, including his home and other illiquid assets, or total available retirement assets. But that builds him up to somewhere around $2 million or so. Maybe not quite $2 million, but just about $2 million, right? Is my math accurate? If $145,000 is 5%, that's about $2 million.
Almost $3
million. $3 million? Mm-hmm. Okay, you can see why I don't do math without my calculator. The purchase of the QLAC seemed like a no-brainer to us because it boosted our emotional concerns of future coverage of our minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. I love that last line.
Yep.
He's essentially saying, folks, he's got plenty of money. This $145,000 was just 5% of his, I don't know by net worth if he means liquid net worth, he has $3 million of assets, or total net worth. liquid retirement assets mm-hmm. plus equity in his home and other maybe illiquid assets. I don't know. But he's pointing out it's a small percentage, mm-hmm. but it's giving him so much emotional relaxation to mm-hmm. know at age 80, if both he and his wife or one of them is alive, this magical annuity is going to turn on and start paying them $25,000 a year for the rest of their lives. Maybe they'll only live another year or two. Maybe they'll live another 15 years. Who knows? But the $25,000 a year will pay out, and he feels comfortable with that. He wants to know, do we have a problem with this? Do you?
No. Do you want me to expand? Or?
Yeah.
For all the things, I mean, he talked through all the convincing factors. He's not handing over a large amount, so even if it turns out they don't need it, the regret is minimized or quite small. That's the first thing I always look at when people are pushing to solve it early. And by solving it early, it's they're thinking about doing something before our proposal, which is to wait and see how things go before you actually hand the money over to the insurance company. That's kind of our default, I would call it, because that's the common way that we encourage people to think about it. We want you to commit to setting it aside, the money that you might need to deploy such a strategy, but wait and see how things go, right? When somebody's wanting to kind of check that box off, especially for emotional reasons, we don't dismiss that. That is absolutely important. A lot of our process and philosophy is geared towards addressing the emotions of retirement planning, not just the financial math of retirement planning. And so a lot of times I'll say, well, you know what? Let's say you don't end up needing the income for some reason. That doesn't mean it's worthless. It just means you've got income coming in that you didn't need to cover your minimum dignity floor. It'll go to your fund expenses. And by that time, it might fund a big chunk of it because you'll be in your 80s. You'll be after the go-go period, etc. As long as you're going to be okay with worst case scenario, you're going to have to live with some income coming in and you're not sacrificing your liquidity substantially by turning over way too much percentage. And he said his was only 5%, but someone who had more modest retirement savings, I would be hesitant to have them hand over a large chunk to this because of the liquidity issues. But in his case, he's kind of addressed all that. He's recognized there's a bunch of emotional benefit. He's pointed out that the downside is very minimal as far as, gee, what if they bought something they ends up they don't, quote, need? It's not like it becomes worthless. They at least have the return of premium feature on it, and it's going to be income, even if it turns out they don't need quite that much to satisfy the minimum dignity floor. It's nice to know it's going to be coming in, and they could use it for something else. If it turns out they don't need it at all, they could even give it away to kids or something once it starts coming in, if they're 80 and that's the circumstances. So in their case, I don't really see any downside to this, because I would put at the top of the list what he emphasized, the emotional comfort he's getting from this decision that has very small negative financial consequences, if any. If any, there might not be negative consequences because he may very well need it. And at 80, he's going to look back with hindsight and say, boy, the 64-year-old us was a genius because, look, we needed this income. So glad that we did it. It was totally worth it. The downside I'm talking about, the negative consequences are you realize you didn't need it, or you know, something comes up where you could have used that money for something else, but it's trapped in this annuity. I think that likelihood is so small in their case that there's really not, it's not worth talking about a lot of the negative parts of this, because I just don't see any substantial negative impacts potential for his circumstances the way he describes it.
Yeah, I would agree too with everything that Chris just said. And I'll just add a little bit more clarity to how we look at QLACs. Mm-hmm. We do occasionally recommend them to people because of their unique factors. And he doesn't get into his $3 million. Again, if it's including illiquid assets like home equity or others, or just liquid assets. And he doesn't tell us the tax diversification, how much he has in always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. But let's just assume, folks, for the sake of argument, most of their $3 million is in an always taxable retirement accounts like an IRA, 401k, 457, or any combination. So accounts where withdrawals in retirement are going to be subject to taxes. It is quite possible the QLAC is going to help allow perhaps tax planning for a longer period of time earlier in retirement. I don't know if it would fit perfectly with him, with the dollar amounts, but we have seen examples, as we do in analysis, that if we could reduce RMDs, it affords the opportunity to do more Roth conversions. You're allowed to put $145,000 in a QLAC, but that's per husband and wife. They only opened one, so it's leading to me to believe most of the always taxable IRA money, which is where you would buy a QLAC, is in one spouse's name, not two. Or they made a calculation that they only need the emotional protection of an additional $25,000 a year at age 80. They don't need more. But to us, when it comes to a QLAC decision, I like to see a couple of yeses to these four questions. First, do you need more secure income in the future? That's the first question. It could be a blatant crossover point, undoubtedly, based on the projections we know today is going to happen. Or it could be a closing of the gap between secure income and minimum dignity floor. Maybe not a crossover point, but they're getting so close, you just want to put some protection in place now in case that happens. But is there a need for more secure income? Do you have excessive RMDs and want to reduce them? Excessive in the sense, not because they're large. We have clients with very large RMDs, but they're not excessive. In other words, the analysis projects they're going to do what with those RMDs, Chris?
They're going to spend them whether they were RMDs or not.
Exactly. You might have people misconstrue the word excessive with large. We have clients with large RMDs that are not excessive.
Well, and we call them excess RMDs.
Excessive
does sound like big. So excess, whether they're small, medium, or big, just means there's more being forced out than you are naturally intending to spend. So there's an excess that you need to figure out something to do with. How do you want to put that to best use is the question. Other people are spending all their RMDs plus some. There's no excess RMD. And I tell people it's a moot point they're even considered RMDs because, look, you're planning to spend it whether they were forcing it out or not.
Exactly. If you have more in RMDs being forced out or projected to force out than you are projecting you're going to spend, then yes, you do have excess required minimum distributions, and maybe QLACs will work at reducing them, and QCDs and other strategies that we won't get into. So again, if you answer yes to a couple of these questions, do you need secure income? Do you have excess RMDs? A very important one, the L in QLAC, longevity. Does longevity and the potential of you living a long time run in your family? Have you survived some horrendous disease and have doctors told you you're probably not going to live more than 5 years? Could you benefit from a QLAC or a DIA or any type of lifetime income payout? Probably not. But if you're still playing cards with your father who's 105 and you're 70... maybe. Do you have longevity or your spouse have longevity? And the one that he keyed in on, are you looking for simplicity and safety? Just be done with it. Let's take care of this. Let me wipe this off my to-do list of things to worry about. Let's just take care of this now for the older me. Are you looking for that? If you can answer yes to a couple of those, his approach to covering minimum dignity floor makes perfect sense. But equally compelling for Chris and I would be to put the reserve aside and let the older you, if and when the shortage occurs, to purchase an income annuity, one or the other. Our point is, it is non-negotiable. The younger you has to put a plan in place to take care of the older you and guarantee the older you will be able to cover their minimum dignity floor for the rest of their lives and not worry. We favor lifetime secure income to do that, not everybody. So I kind of like that. The other questions, because I know we're going to be running short on time, but they are interesting and so closely related with each other. I'm going to get through this first one because I think you're just going to say, listen to my previous answer, Chris.
Okay.
It says, hi, Jim and Chris and your entire team. You have a very educational and entertaining podcast. You can call me George from North Dakota. My question is, when figuring out the minimum dignity floor crossover point, here's another crossover point question. You see a little trend on today's show?
Mm-hmm.
I'm 61 and retired military. I want to delay my Social Security until 70. My military pension, and with my military pension, my minimum dignity floor is covered. However, my Social Security statement says beginning in 2035, 80% of promised benefits may be paid. To make matters worse, I was also born in 1960. If these cuts happen, I think with my projections, I will be short in my late 80s mm-hmm. with taking care of my minimum dignity floors. At least he used the qualifier if. Mm-hmm. If the cuts happen. So my thoughts are, maybe I should buy something now, maybe I-bonds or TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, to help cover that shortfall if and when Social Security reduction may happen. Remember, Chris, he's only 61 now. Mm-hmm. This shortfall he's projecting, if the cuts even happen, right, won't be till his late 80s, could be 23, 24 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I am fully retired, and with my minimum pension, my floor is covered with Social Security, as he already mentioned. I do have long-term care insurance already in place that should cover 5 years of a fully insurable event. What are your thoughts? Any insights would be appreciated. I would say, my quick, brief summary, mm-hmm. I love how you said, if the cuts, listener, if the cuts don't happen, there may not be a shortfall. Should a reserve be left in TIPS and I-bonds for something that may not happen? Even if the cuts do happen, you don't project needing this money for 20-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can take more investment risk than TIPS and I-bonds. We tend to use TIPS, I-bonds, brokered CDs, bank CDs, money market accounts, aftermarket T-bills, new issue T-bill, aftermarket treasury notes, new issue T-bills. All of these types of products we use in our cash management and principal protected approaches. I personally don't think, unless from an emotional standpoint, he can't handle investment risk. I love the idea of putting money aside. If something happens, you just want to help the older you in the late 80s, or if your minimum dignity floor expenses exceed your military pension and Social Security COLAs. But I think you can afford a little more investment mm-hmm. growth potential than I-bonds and TIPS. That's all I have to say. I like it. I like putting a reserve aside, I think the risk capacity of those dollars is far higher than what TIPS and I-bonds would afford.
I agree. There's more risk capacity there, most likely, where I don't think I-bonds or TIPS would be the best approach for what he's talking about to handle a goal or need that he's identified in his late 80s, over 20 years away. But if he really is averse to some of that, then maybe he should review our discussion we just had on QLACs, right? Or you know, DIAs in general. There's that he could extract himself from that kind of investment risk, but have a, you know, a situation where it would generate him income in the future. But comes with all the same caveats that we went through before. I'm not going to regurgitate them all. So he'd want to make sure that it checks several of the yes boxes to see if it makes sense. And I think he's old enough now in his 60s that it's not likely that he's going to suffer a 20% reduction in his Social Security benefits. But I obviously could be wrong. And if he wants to prepare for that, setting aside some money in some vehicle would make sense. I just think TIPS and I-bonds probably too conservative for a need 20 plus years out that may or may not happen.
We love the idea, listener and listeners, of a reserve. Even if one's not projected, we always ask our clients when we're working with them, do you want to put some extra money aside? We call it a buffer. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that he's doing that. I just don't think I-bonds and TIPS are an appropriate hold for this. Right. You should look for some growth opportunities because you're not going to need it for a very long time. The next ones all have to do with minimum dignity floor and fun. So I think all these questions are related, so it's good. They all recently came in. Jim?
Well, I don't know that we'll have time to do a bunch more. We've only got a few more minutes left.
Okay, so. Well, I'll start with the shorter one.
Okay.
And if we have time, they all have to do with fun and minimum dignity floor. You might be able to squeeze them all in. Okay. I don't know. Jim and Chris, all caps on and, by the way. Jim and Chris. And this is more of your question. Do you modify and adjust your minimum dignity floor calculations as it relates to the go-go, slow-go, and no-go years? And I wrote myself on the page, Chris, fun question mark. Is he asking, because we specify go-go, slow-go, and no-go as fun spending, not minimum dignity floor.
Right.
Fun. And we're going to do a whole series of show on our concept of fun number. I doubt it'll be as long as minimum dignity floor, but it'll be a very interesting series of shows. So anyways, do you modify and adjust your calculations of the minimum dignity floor as it relates to the go-go, slow-go, and no-go years? Since transportation costs and health care do change with age, it would be likely that these costs will also change. I interpreted that as a question on do we adjust fund spending, or are you interpreting this another way?
No, I think he's asking do we apply the go-go, slow-go, no-go approach to minimum dignity floor expenses,
and
that's a resounding no.
No, if that's the way, I agree. Explain why.
No, because those expenses are just your basic living, or say food, you know, how much you eat. Do you have a go-go period? Honestly, Jim, and I started this thought, I guess, several weeks ago now when I brought up the fact that some of the minor reductions in food consumption that we were modeling in our minimum dignity floor, probably it's time to revisit that idea. But for the most part, you don't go on a binge and force feed yourself more than you normally eat just because it's the go-go period. And they don't drastically cut as you age. You might eat a little bit less, but do you buy less? No, you probably just waste a little bit more. So food's pretty much the same. Do you, in the go-go period, do you run around the house and turn on all your lights because it's the go-go period and we're going to use up as much electricity as possible? No, those aren't behavior-driven as far as the concept of go-go. Go-go is you being active, going out and spending because you've got time and money to burn through in retirement now that you've worked so hard to accumulate and now you're going to spend a bunch of it. That's what we're talking about. And that's discretionary fund spending. That's not the basics of living in food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. Healthcare, we say, goes up and up and up and up. A, as you age, it goes up. because older people just have more medical issues, and there's inflation that has been pressuring healthcare expenses quite a lot as well. We don't try to model those, you know, heavier earlier. That's what go-go means, is it's heavy earlier. If anything, medical would be the opposite of that. So no, completely different application, I think, to the go-go concept. That we don't bring that into the discussion of minimum dignity floor. Other factors drive those expenses.
Right. In your go-go phase early in retirement, when you're healthy and you're not going to go out and consume more healthcare during the go-go phase.
Right.
So no. I misunderstood his question then. It didn't really have to do with fun. So I love your answer. I promise this one has to do with fun. Concerning your minimum dignity floor calculation, when I look at my spending, I divide my minimum dignity, I divide off my minimum dignity floor items. I'm not quite sure what he means by that.
Probably separate off. Yeah, separate them.
I have also separated out, yeah, I guess you're right. I have also separated out items which are clearly fun spending. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. So do we. Your minimum dignity floor is not fun.
Right.
If you're writing the check for that bill or Venmoing it or online bill paying it or however you pay your bills, if you're writing that check, because I still write checks, I know that's sad, but I do. If I'm writing that check and I'm thinking, oh my God, that was so fun when I spent this money, that's not minimum dignity floor. Because I don't get really excited about paying my utility bill or my cell phone bill. Keep that in mind. Okay, here he says, Chris, I have also separated items which I clearly find to be fun spending. My vacations, my RV and the related expenses of the RV, my red sports car, and the like. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy has to be a bachelor. Mm-hmm. What about those things that are regular daily spending items during the go-go phase? And I will spend less on them during the slow-go phase and probably minimal during the no-go phase. I think he's misunderstanding slow-go, no-go, and no-go. Slow-go, go-go, slow-go, no-go. How do you adjust for dining out, clothing, birthdays, Christmas gifts, wine and alcohol, movies, concerts, amusement parks, and the like? Mm-hmm. Are all these things supposed to come out of my fun spending? Or is there another category you didn't mention that we should be looking at? Maybe called daily living expenses, the DLE. Clearly, these go down over time and will eventually disappear, much like my fun spending. Remember, Chris, he's identifying his fun as his vacation, his RV, and his red sports car. Mm-hmm. He's missing the boat for the forest.
Yeah.
But they are routine. Let me finish. They are routine and part of our lifestyle. Oh, he's not single. Our lifestyle for the time being. Mm-hmm. How do we account for these items? And what happens to our minimum dignity floor when we go into full-time nursing home? Won't all a part of my minimum dignity floor go away? Two good questions. Answer them and we'll wrap up for today.
So he's making a distinction between kind of large dollar amount splurge items, red sports car, RV, etc., and making a difference or drawing a difference differentiator between them and your more mundane fun expenses like entertainment, dining out, etc. That's all fun. That's all things that we want you to fund in retirement. It's not a matter of funding or not funding. It's just the mechanism we propose for funding it, because it is so front-loaded, and discretionary, adjustable. We don't propose that you fund all of those things with secure income like we do the minimum dignity floor to create that foundation, but we let you fund or encourage you to fund those things just with distributions from your assets, particularly paying attention to the fact that you're going to spend more on those things during the go-go period than later on when you might spend very little or even zero on many of them. So we're categorizing it two ways. Could you add complexity to our approach and come up with three or four different categories instead of two that we use, minimum dignity floor and fun? Yeah, you could. I don't know that it would add a tremendous amount of benefit over our approach. We've considered it, looked at all kinds of different things. Doesn't mean our approach is perfect by any means, but that's what he's proposing, I think, is kind of an additional fun category, kind of mundane fun, we might call it. We treat fun differently in that we look at some that are going to go up and down during retirement. He mentioned gifting birthdays. Those we usually project to the end consistently. Do you have a go-go birthday period? Most people not. You know, they're going to gift a certain amount and it continues. So some things aren't affected by the go-go, slow-go idea. Others very much are. The travel, the RV, the sports car, that's going to be front-loaded very heavily. But it all falls into our category that we call fun. As far as minimum dignity floor when you go into nursing home, well, guess what? When you're there, you still need food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. Maybe not transportation, although assisted living, they still do transportation. All that gets replaced by the cost to go in there, right? And the question is, will substituting those costs be equivalent to my minimum dignity floor? And usually they're higher. It's more expensive to take care of you with all these factors in a professional facility than at your own home. Thus, the need for additional resources or maybe long-term care insurance or something to embellish. But you're right, there is a diversionary factor, not necessarily for the first spouse, because the community spouse, we call them, will still have to support the household and have most of the minimum dignity floor expenses. When the second of you leaves, then there's a big substitution where all those old minimum dignity floor expenses go away and are replaced with a big hefty assisted living fee, nursing home fee, those kinds of things, and a good examination of whether you'll have enough to replace or not, or you need some embellishment through additional resources of your own or through insurance makes sense to look at.
Okay, I like the answer. And that's going to wrap it up, folks, as I promised Chris we would end on time. And if I start another question, you know we won't.
For sure.
We do have 10 MDF-related questions left. It will be totally up to Chris if half of these 10 are answered next week or none of them. There's no way we're going to get 10 answered next week, and we're not doing another MDF show past next week. Okay. Chris will decide next week if we're going to do another MDF show on the EDU.
We'll see how my Labor Day weekend goes, what kind of mood I'm in when I come back.
Oh, yes. I want to wish everybody a happy... I thought it was still 2 weeks away. I just realized this is coming weekend. Yeah, so I hope everybody has a nice Labor Day. Those 10 people, maybe 5 of you will be answered, maybe not. If not, you're just going to get rolled into all the other printed questions I have, and eventually we'll get to them, but probably not till several months. But we'll let Chris decide if we'll do one more EDU show on the MDF. Anyways, I think these questions... You can clearly see people are taking this serious. They understand the concept. I like that. This again, is a concept we came up with. It's a concept that I wanted to do. It just makes sense to me. And I'm glad people are at least paying attention. They may not follow us to the T letter, but they're definitely incorporating it into their calculations and the concept and theory of the younger you helping the older you. Remember, folks, keep it simple for the older you. And there's nothing more reassuring than to be 80, 85, 90, knowing your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care are going to be covered with lifetime secure income coming in, no matter what the economy is doing, the geopolitical issues, the markets. Just, you don't have to worry about that when you're older, and you're not going to want to worry. So I'm pleased with the amount of questions we got in. It at least shows me, Chris, that people are thinking about it.
Nice. Well, we'll see next week what the show will be.
No, you'll see. I'm leaving it all up to you.
You all see what I decide, and I'll try not to let you down.
Whatever you decide.
Yeah, we'll see. We want to thank everybody for sending in the questions. Makes these shows easy to fill with a topic, for sure. If you want to send in your own questions, maybe for the regular Q&A show, send those directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Make sure in the subject line you indicate it's a podcast question. And
especially that it's unique, I'm brilliant, and Kentucky and
stuff
Ohio
like that
are
apparently
awesome.
Works to get you on the show. So. We appreciate it, everybody, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning, They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.